Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Home Interrupted, a new podcast from our partners at Feet in Two Worlds. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to
Whoa!
Potluck.
And you're listening to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Ye.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And on today's episode, we have another amazing author interview for you. We're talking with Andrea Wang, the author of the new middle grade novel, The Many Meanings of Mei Lan, that releases today, August 17th, 2021. So if you'd like our conversation, go pick up her book. It's available at booksellers everywhere, both physical and online. But do please also support your local bookstores. But if you can't make it to one, support us and local bookstores by buying the book on our bookshop.org page. Rira, do you have any initial thoughts about our conversation or the Many Meanings of Mei Lan?
So you and I have names that are unique in terms of pronunciation. So you and I had many thoughts about how names are important in Asian culture and how that is tied to our family and our identity. And it's really great that this book explores all of that in a very accessible way for young readers. So I had a great time chatting with Andrea about it.
Yeah, it's as if this book was tailor-made for me, because not only do I share the same, one of the same letters as Chinese letters, quote unquote, as the main character, Mei Lan. Our grandfathers also have very similar experiences. And we say this a lot with children's literature, especially Asian American own voices, children's literature. But this is the book that we wish we had growing up, or I wish I had growing up.
Yeah, definitely. And I didn't mention it in our interview, but it is nice that like the main character is like, that's racist, like, don't say that, and they're able to stand up for themselves. Because as a kid, like, even though I knew someone was being microaggressive with their racism, I'm like, I'm not gonna say anything because I don't know if it's worth my energy. So it was really nice to read a character who, you know, actually put in the effort to educate and also to stand up for themselves and to really call out a lot of the problematic things.
Yeah, and when you illustrate issues like that in a book for youth, you equip the readers with the language to approach or address those same issues if and when they run into them in real life. So, you know, the power of youth literature. That's why we're always promoting or excited when we see new picture books, new middle grade novels, new authors writing diverse stories for youth, because it's not only great for representation for Asian American youth, but also great for, you know, the general public to have a better understanding of what it's like to grow up as a minority in this country.
So without further ado, we're going to move on to our interview with Andrea Wang. Enjoy. And we're here with Andrea Wang, who is the award-winning author of the picture books, The Nian Monster, Magic Ramen, and also her debut middle grade novel, The Many Meanings of Mei Lan. Welcome, Andrea. It's such a pleasure to have you.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
So you are a picture book author, and like, we've never had a picture book author on this show before, so I'm a bit curious as to like how you got started in that field?
So I started actually writing picture books after my kids were born. I think that's true of a lot of children's book authors. And I'd been reading a lot of picture books to them. I fell in love with that genre again, that format, and started trying to write them. But everything I wrote and got critiqued, people were saying, this really should be a longer story. This needs to be a longer book. Have you thought about chapter books? So when I applied to an MFA program, I got my MFA from Lesley University in Massachusetts. I submitted a middle grade manuscript, and that's what I worked on my entire 2 years in the program. And I sort of wrote, because novels are a long haul, so I wrote picture books on the side. And it was kind of like, okay, I still really love this format. But I really wasn't thinking that much about it. I was more serious about the middle grade. And after I graduated, I actually found more success with the picture books. And my first contract was for The Nian Monster. And so I've been a little surprised to find myself as a picture book author first, but I'm really happy that I've come back to writing middle grade. And, you know, picture books, though, have been sort of my focus for the past few years.
I love that one of your first books was The Nian Monster, because I remember my mom telling me about The Nian Monster. And that was why, I don't know if your family did this, but we kept our lights on every New Year to keep the monster away. Because, like, that's why you hang lanterns, right? To, like, keep them away.
I actually had never heard that folktale before. My parents never told me that growing up. So I was looking around for, you know, things about Lunar New Year to tell my own kids. And I came across that. And I was like, oh my gosh, I should tell this.
To this day, I still leave the lights on, which, now that I think about it, it costs a lot of power for that night. But, you know, got to keep the monster away so it doesn't eat us.
That's right.
In our news episodes every month, we announce like book deals, and it's always great to see a lot of picture books by Asian authors show up, because growing up, there were zero picture books with Asian characters, and like books where they were written by Asian author illustrators, the main characters were usually like animals. So it was just like, I never saw myself growing up. And it's just so nice that I have nephews, and English is their second language, so I'm able to give them picture books where the characters actually look like them, and it's just so nice because there's actually options now.
Yeah, it's great.
I was trying to remember like picture book representation from when I was a kid, and the only thing I could think of was this book called it was like Tiki Tiki Tembo. Do you guys remember that?
Yeah.
And now that I think back about it, I mean, it's obviously did not age well at all. And the meaning of the book is actually the exact opposite of the meaning of Meilan, your latest novel, which is like, horror names are really long. You should shorten it so that you don't die if you fall in the whole well.
I didn't really read that book growing up, but I just remember thinking, wait, most Chinese names are like one syllable, two syllables. I'm really confused by this. The one picture book I remember growing up was The Five Chinese Brothers. Have you ever read that?
Yeah, I remember that.
And I remember like, oh, this is about Chinese people. But now when I look back, that didn't age well either, because, you know, the town can't tell any of the brothers apart. And I'm like, really? Why is that?
Yeah. Thank you for providing our teachers more stories to share that has better representation of Asian children and stories.
My pleasure.
Oh, sorry. Okay. So it says in your bio that you spent your childhood in Ohio and Boston. So I'm just curious, like, what was it like growing up there? Did you grow up in like a predominantly Asian populated town or...
So no, actually, I was born in Cambridge, Massachusetts. But when I was 2 years old, my parents moved our family, which included my big brother and myself, to a very small town in Ohio. So Meilan's town is sort of modeled after the town where I grew up, from when I was 2 years old to when I was 13. And it was predominantly white. There were some African-American families there. It was considered and still is considered a very progressive liberal town. But this is the 70s that I was growing up there, you know. So a lot of the experiences that Meilan has sort of mirror my own. It was hard to grow up there. I definitely felt very other My recent picture book, actually, Watercress, which came out this past March, is also set in a very small rural town in Ohio, and is about the girl feeling, you know, othered.
Yeah. I guess since we're on your book, can you share with our listeners a brief synopsis of what The Many Meanings of Mei-Lan is about?
Sure. The Many Meanings of Mei-Lan is about a young Chinese-American girl who's grown up her whole life with her extended family in Boston's Chinatown, where her family runs the Chinese bakery, and they live in an apartment building above it. And she tells stories. She's a storyteller, and she loves books, and she tells this story to her younger cousin, and she feels like it leads to her family falling apart, especially after her grandmother dies. And her family sets out on the road. They end up moving away from the rest of her extended family and end up in a small town in Ohio called Redbud. And there she sort of encounters a lot of microaggressions and racism. And she's trying to deal with this for the first time. And at the same time, she's being renamed. So she's dealing with the loss of her identity in many ways. And that sort of leads to her separating herself into different sort of personalities or personas based on the different meanings of her name in Mandarin.
Yeah.
I thought
we were, and I were talking about this before or yesterday when we were discussing this interview, and we both felt like this was like there's some pretty heavy themes here for like a book for kids. Like how much of this was autobiographic? Like the some of the characters in your story are like very, very mean and very, very like racist, right? So like did you have to encounter that a lot when you were growing up as well?
I did. And you know, I think I've blocked a lot of the specific instances. But I do remember very clearly in sixth grade that one of the boys in my class called me a half-breed. And I mean, I was really confused, right? Because my parents are both Chinese. So like on a technical level, it didn't make any sense. But I understood, you know, the ill intent behind it. And I did find it very hurtful. You know, and I was made fun of for, you know, having Chinese parents. I was often asked if I was adopted, or, you know, just everything. So my parents had to deal with their car being keyed or people making fun of them as well because they spoke with an accent, etc. So it was a lot to navigate. So I think that, you know, middle schoolers, especially Asian American middle schoolers, often do deal with this type of microaggression.
And I feel like the worst ones come from like the person that's in power, the principal, Mr. Rayner, who is the person who renames Mei-Lan, right? Did you ever have to deal with like a adult figure that was that mean to you as a child?
Thankfully, no. My parents immigrated here at a time when, you know, assimilation was the thing, right? So they gave me and my older brother American names. So I didn't really have to deal with that. And my maiden last name was Chan. So that was pretty easy to pronounce. But I think that I was writing this and the principal figure came into mind because it's so much more damaging, as you say, when someone in a position of power renames you against your will. And I had had critique partners say, well, that would never happen. Right? Like teachers and principals are too woke for this now. And I'm like, you know? And literally like within the next 2 weeks, my other critique partner said, you know what? This just happened to my friend's daughter. My friend went to like the art show at her daughter's school and saw that her daughter had signed Nora on her drawing instead of Noor. And she's like, why did you write that? That's not your name. She's like, well, that's what the teacher insists on calling me. So it really still does happen.
Yeah. As someone who has a very uncommon name, both in English and in Korean, like I totally felt the whole renaming, like microaggression. When I immigrated here to the States, the immigration officer who was like filling out our paperwork, he was like, okay, what's your name? And I said, oh, it's Rira. And they're like, okay, Rira. And then they spelled it phonetically. And for my brother, his Korean name is Chiseok. And the second my parents said that, they're like, oh no, like that's going to be too hard to pronounce. So even though that was his legal name, when he went to school, we called him Brian. And, you know, we still call him Brian because that's what he's more comfortable with. But yeah, I definitely went to school with teachers insisting that I go by a different name. And I would just be like, I don't understand, like, why, like, it's not that hard. Like, there are so many other Asians with more difficult names than mine. Like, I don't understand. So the fact that her principal is telling her, like, oh, well, it's too hard to pronounce, I was just like, excuse me? Like, even as an adult reading this, it felt like I was re-experiencing a lot of the, not trauma, but a lot of rage that I felt as a kid, but was unable to express.
Also, as like a Chinese person, it's not that hard to say Mulan.
I know, that's
literally
the thing.
How it sounds
phonetically.
It's not
that hard. Like, how did he get Mulan out of Mulan? How did he get Hue out of Hua? Like it's just like, I know English pronunciation does not make sense because English is a broken language and pronunciation can go any way possible. But like, look at the spelling. Just sound it out.
I think there's actually this thing that happens. People have studied where if you know the person is not white, Caucasian, European, you tend to make their names sound more foreign and more difficult than they actually are. It's sort of like people tend to try and want to complicate it.
Yeah. No, I get that because my last name is one of those syllables that is just impossible for Western tongues to pronounce. It's yes. Yue, as in like music, right? But that UE is just impossible. But then they see me, they want to say UE, UA, U. It's one syllable, but they want to extend it because it's a foreign name. So it has to be complicated, right? And it's, yeah. So whenever I pronounce it, I say it the correct way. But when someone else tries, I mean, I give them a B for effort.
A B for effort. Before we started this interview, we asked Andrea, like, oh, do you go by Wang or Wang? And this is a thing that all Asian Americans with like Asian last names go through. Like I'm remembering when we had Sarah Seok on our show. Actually, her Korean pronunciation is Seok, but she goes by Suk, which is how Americans pronounce it. And it's just so weird to me that we have to code switch all the time. And I don't know, like because we're so used to people calling us by the bastardization of our Asian names, like it's hard to say which one is real, like which one is the more authentic one, because you go by whatever pronunciation you're called by for most of your life.
That's so true. I, you know, Wang is my married name and my husband always said Wang. So I said Wang. And it's spelled with an A. And I discovered that I say it's Wang, which is the correct Mandarin pronunciation, people spell it with an O. And to further complicate matters, my husband's family have spread out from China to Hong Kong, to Australia, to the United States. And depending on where they emigrated to, it was spelled with either an A or an O. So like half of his relatives have W-O-N-G and the other half have W-A-N-G. So it's all, and I tell people, I don't really care, I guess, how you pronounce it because it's Wang in the Western world and it's Wang in the Asian world. And, you know, but then people don't like that because they want to know for sure what to call me. And
yeah,
I just go by what's easier. I'm like, you know, it's Wang because it's spelled with an A.
So I really like the idea of Mei-Lan kind of going by different variations of Lan, her name. I'm not Chinese, I'm not Taiwanese, so like it was really interesting to me to see all these different definitions of just one word. Can you talk a little bit more about like your decision in making her have all of these sub-identities.
I've always been fascinated by all the homophones that are in the Mandarin language, because it still does trip me up a lot. And my own Chinese name in Mandarin is Yu Ru. And again, kind of like Marvin Yue, it's that Yu that no one can ever really say unless you've grown up pronouncing it. And I hated telling people my Chinese name. And even when I told my parents' friends that my name was Yu Ru, in which the Yu part, my father wrote the character that means fragrant, which is sort of an archaic version. But Yu more commonly means jade. So everybody thought that, you know, my Chinese name meant jade. And it wasn't. I mean, but I loved that name. And I was like, I really kind of wish it did mean jade rather than being like fragrant, which of course, you know, could mean that I was smelly or, you know, unhygienic or something. So it started from there. And it also started from nicknames that I had as a child. My grandfather lived with us for a while, and he called me this term of endearment in Mandarin, Xiaoyato, which means little girl. But I'd never seen the characters. I didn't know what it meant. And in my own mind, Ya, Marvin sees where this is going. Ya means duck. That's how I, so I thought he was calling me little duck head for most of my childhood, which I thought was really cute. But then my mother, you know, when I was grown, told me, no, no, that means little girl. Like, oh.
I think it's more akin to like little brat, right? Like,
my mother actually said it was like, it's really not that nice. It could mean servant girl. So she was not happy about it, but I didn't know. I thought I was being called like a little duck. So, and from there, it sort of, I wanted to explore the idea of code switching, as you were talking about earlier, and, you know, how we behave differently in different situations. And so I paid a lot of attention when I was choosing Meilan's name, and I wanted to, you know, pick one that had a lot of different homophones where I could pick and choose meanings that would correspond to, you know, how she felt in certain situations. And when I saw that Lan can also be basket, I was like, oh, that's it. Because I wanted to explore this concept of filial piety, and, you know, having all these expectations of your parents sort of weighing you down. And so it kind of took off from there.
Oh, I mean, it's a brilliant device, and it definitely hit those notes. I mean, I was definitely vibing with the feelings of the just all the pressure of trying to be a good kid when the world seems to be turning against you somehow. And Chinese names are such, like, I haven't seen them discussed in such detail in literature before. And it's always interesting because my name has always been kind of like, Riru and I have talked about this before. We have like strange names within our own cultures. Like my last name, Yue, is, I don't know what's the, it's a poinzi, which means it has two different pronunciations for the same word. Right? It means music, but it can also be pronounced le, which means joy or happiness. Right? But it's the same exact word. And I, in Asia, in China and Taiwan, I respond to both. I respond to both yue or le. And then my Chinese name itself, my parents gave it to me as my middle name. So my middle name is Mei Hong. So I have the same first letter as Mei Lan, which is typically used for girls' names because it means beautiful. In my family, we have like a naming convention. So every generation has a generational name. So my generation happens to be May. So all the guys in my generation have quote unquote girls' names, right? and then so my parents try to give me like an extra masculine, like given name, which is my third letter, which is Hong, which means like heroic and great, but it's also a homophone for red. So if I tell people my name, it sounds like, oh, my name is beautiful red. Kind of like beautiful blue for Meilan, right?
Yeah. That's interesting. My younger son's Chinese name also has that same Hong character, but I hadn't really thought about the red aspect of it.
Yeah, I like really appreciated the fact that you went into detail with how special names are in Asian culture. Not to dunk on American culture too much, but a lot of parents like name their kids weird names, like for absolutely no reason. They'll like, how many people name their child Khaleesi after Game of Thrones? Like, so
To be fair, my father named me after Marvin Hamlick, composer. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Cool.
And I'm pretty sure he named my brother after Max Headroom, the 80s robot man.
Yeah, yeah. It's my brother's name is Ezra, which is unusual for, you know, a Chinese American guy. It's a very Jewish name, but it's an homage to the man who brought my father over from China. So.
Yeah, I think like the idea, the tradition of Asian names and how much thought goes into them. I know like some Asian cultures, like you don't name your child until like a certain number of days past the birth of the child. And I know for my family, we also have a naming tradition, and there was like a lot of debate in my family on what to name me. But grandfather had like all of the power, so my parents didn't like my name. But too bad, my grandfather's like, this is gonna be her name. Like, I don't care if you don't like it.
That's how it is, though. That's also touched upon in your book as well, like the grandparents gave me on their name. And I forgot who gave me my Chinese name, but I do have a funny story about Chinese names and that as well. My cousin's children, my aunt named them, but I don't know if she forgot or didn't pay attention, but there's two boys who are both Jiewen, but they're different words. So their names sound the same, but they're different names.
That just sounds like torture. Why would you do that?
That's very confusing.
Did you do that on purpose, or did you just forget what you named the other boy?
But I think because like so much thought goes into naming like your Asian children, like the fact that like Mei Lan, like her being renamed into Melanie, it's even more painful because it's like there's so much love, there's so much prayer that goes into the name, and it's like, oh, like, you're taking everything that my family wished for me to become when they named me this. And I don't know, like when I was reading the book, like even though it was like I was in page like 150, it's been numerous chapters since the principal renamed Mei Lan into Melanie. I was like, I can't get over this. I just like can't. Like, it's like, I'm so mad, but this happened like over 100 pages ago. I just can't let it go.
I've actually been hearing that from other friends who've read it as well, that they're just, it resonates so strongly with them. And, you know, I grew up always responding to the wrong name because I was always called the other Asians, in the class's name.
Oh my God.
Or I just sort of let it roll off me, you know, because it just happened so often. My brother's Chinese name is Da Wei, which sounds a lot like David. So all of my mother's friends would call him David, and it's not his English name. And, you know, we've just sort of all kind of like, you know, it's whatever battle you want to pick for that day, right? Like, am I going to speak up for myself and say that's not my name? I think I tended to speak up more when people called me Connie for Connie Chung. I'm dating myself here, but you know, or my brother would be called Bruce for Bruce Lee. I think that happens to a lot of Asian men.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, even though I personally wasn't renamed by a principal, I mean, I've always had to deal with being called the wrong name.
Yeah. And I feel like there's been a shift in the last maybe like decade or two where, like this, and maybe it's coinciding with like this surge in Asian American identity being more prominent in our pop culture, in our books, in our movies, in our film, in our TV, where people are now like, because I remember as a kid, there were friends who had Asian names as their legal names, taking on English names just to either to fit in or just as part of their identity. And it seems like there's been like an inversion of that lately, that people are more, I guess, for lack of a better word, proud, or have more pride in their cultural identities. I mean, have you seen that shift in your world as well as a children's book writer?
I have, actually. There have been several picture books that have come out recently. I think starting several years ago with The Name Jar, which is about a young Korean girl who, you know, immigrates to the United States, and her classmates think that her name's too hard to say. And they put all these names into a jar and want her to pick one, but she ultimately decides that she's going to stick with her, you know, original true name. And then more recently, Your Name is a Song, Your Name, you know, and other picture books like that. I think that's, it's great that we're sort of reclaiming our names because they tie us to our heritage. And they're such a huge part of our identity, which is not to say that you can't rename yourself. I mean, if you feel like your name doesn't suit you, by all means, rename yourself, take power over that. But it's completely different when someone else does it to you.
Yeah, definitely. I want to talk about the Chinese that you write in your book, The Mandarin. You spell out a lot of the phonetic phrases. And as someone who like does not speak Chinese, read Chinese, not familiar with Mandarin at all, it was a really interesting experience to me because like half of the things that Meilan's mom would say, I'm like, I have no idea what she's actually saying. I'm relying on the translations, but as like an Asian American, I'm like, that's probably not 100% the translation of what the actual phrasing is. And I'm just thinking about the young readers who are reading this book who kind of have to like rely on context clues. And that's really something that's a new development, I think, in children's books, because a lot of the times publishers will say, you have to italicize the word, you have to have a glossary. And your book doesn't really have a glossary other than like the prophetic sayings that Meilan's mom gives out.
So many four-word, like... was it four-word? What's
idioms?
Yeah, my dad loves using those. And then
is it a Chinese parent thing? Really?
It's just it's the way they learn. Like I think they're originally from like Confucian poems and teachings, right? Like they're like moral idioms that parents used as shorthand for like don't do that. And I love that you had those in there, and you also had that glossary at the end. Like so, this is what they actually mean. This is what the mom means when she says these four-word idioms.
Yeah, and I think that it meant a lot to me to include them in Pinyin because Meilan is growing up in a bilingual household, much the same way I did. And so the reader's perhaps confusion about reading some of them and not understanding what they mean kind of mirrors Meilan's own confusion. I think in the book, you'll see that sometimes she just grows really frustrated with her mom. And she's like, just say what you mean. I don't know what this means. Because as Marvin said, they're based on these old stories or, you know, it's shorthand for these cultural touchstones, I guess, that she has no idea about. And I didn't either as a kid. So, and I wanted to include those because, you know, it's sort of more realistic, I think, of a bilingual household.
Did you have to ask your parents for more of those? I'm guessing that you didn't know all of them at the top of your head.
I didn't. Actually, my parents are both gone now. I would have loved to have asked them, but there are some wonderful books that are all just about these Chinese idioms and where they're from. And I had a ball looking through that and just trying to figure out. There are ones that are sorted by animals or, you know, idioms about plants and idioms about money. And it was really fun to sort of puzzle it together.
If you ever watch like a Chinese drama, especially a Chinese period drama, they speak exclusively in these idioms.
It sounds, I don't know. It just sounds so difficult because it's like... It's like you're processing what they're saying, but are they really saying this? It's just a lot of like mind game tricks that like I feel like idioms is just something that I have never really grasped, even as an adult. I struggle with both like English idioms and Korean idioms because it's just like when you're growing up here and your parents don't speak English or English fluently. You go to school and they're saying all these idioms and you're like, I don't know what that means. Like, I have zero context for this. Like, no one has said these things to me, like, growing up. And then the same thing with, like, Korean idioms with, like, my Korean family. I'm like, don't know what that means, but I am guessing that this is what you're saying. And that brings me to, like, the point with Logan, because there's a scene where Logan and Meilan, they're talking about, like, what their mom says. What both of their moms say, and they're like, oh, I guess moms have the same language because it doesn't matter what idiom they're spewing. It's pretty much saying the exact same thing, exact same message of don't do this.
Yeah, I found that fascinating, actually, that there are, you know, idioms in different languages. And, you know, on the surface, the literal translation is really, really different, but the meaning of it is the same. You know, I think the one that Logan and Meilan are talking about that you're referencing is in Chinese, literally, it means trees, or it means like with, what is it? I can't remember now, but it's something about not being a boat anymore, right? Like a tree isn't a boat. And it's just kind of like, it is what it is. You can't change it anymore. And, you know, Logan's mom says, like, it is what it is. And that's, you know, her idiom.
Yeah. All parenting is the same. So,
exactly. Exactly. We all try to use the same things on our kids to get them to behave.
I want to bring up also one of the heart of the book is Meilan's relationship with her grandfather. And I that was another thing that I also really related to, because like my grandfather was also a veteran of World War II, not the Vietnam War. And like I didn't know about his stories until very late. And I had to hear of them from my mom. And I thought it was just really, it's such a, we talk about this a lot, where a lot of times our immigrant parents don't want to talk about where they came from because either it was hard or because they don't think it's interesting or they just don't think it's needed, right? You don't need to know about our homeland. You're here now. You should learn about your current homeland, right? And but then, right, you know, our parents and our grandparents are getting older, and if we don't ask them, those stories disappear. And I love that that was also a central theme in your story as well, as Meilan kind of getting past her insecurities about asking her grandfather about something that she's not sure he wants to talk about, and learning more about her history as well.
Yeah, and that came out of, you know, my own similar experience of my parents and my grandparents not talking to me about anything that happened back in China. You know, I had to piece some things together myself. And, you know, it really wasn't until I was grown that I discovered that my father had kind of run afoul of the Communist Party and was sent to labor camp and had to escape. And, you know, I mean, yeah, that's the subject of another book, maybe. But, you know, he didn't talk about it. It was really painful and something he wasn't, I don't want to say that he was ashamed of it, but it was just like he had moved on or was trying to move on. But he did still have, you know, I think undiagnosed PTSD. And I wanted to sort of work that in to the story. In this case, it's Meilan's grandfather. My own grandfather also was in the Nationalist Air Force.
Oh, my grandfather as well.
So,
yeah, my grandfather was actually had the same position as Gong Gong in the book. He was a communications officer on the supply plane. So,
oh, neat. Yeah. Oh, wow. What a coincidence. I think my grandfather was like a radio engineer, kind of a communications engineer too. But as I started doing all the research and I found out about this secret ops group called the Black Bats, I was like, that's so cool. I'm putting that in. But all the more reason for him to keep this secret, right? Like it was a covert kind of a thing. But yeah, I really feel strongly that even though it's difficult, we need to tell kids our histories so that they're not lost. And I think I try to do that with all of my books.
I thought it was really interesting because America and Asia, they have very different definitions of duty and different definitions of like what is a veteran. And I don't know, like with America, every single country shows a lot of nationalism, but I feel like with America and the military, it's on a whole different level. I'm not so sure if it's because like nowadays it's, you know, you're not being drafted. It's voluntary. But for a lot of Asian countries that do have military, it's kind of mandatory to serve in the army for like 2 years, 3 years. And I just thought it was really interesting because it challenged your readers to think like, okay, America is not the center of the world. There are other countries that fought in the same war. And we're seeing this more with a lot of Vietnamese American authors who talk about the Vietnam War. And I think it's just been like a really great way for kids to learn more about history, but not from just an American lens. And I think it's really important because like we said earlier, like our parents, our grandparents are getting older and these stories are going to be lost pretty soon if the new generation doesn't pass it on.
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, that concept of duty and ties so closely in with the concept of filial piety, right? That's sort of the basis for, you know, a lot of Chinese American kids' upbringing, right? Like all those Confucian sayings that you're supposed to adhere to. And it was really interesting to me as I did the research to learn that Taiwan, you know, had this sort of mandatory service up until very recently. And it was just sort of accepted as fact, right? That this is what something that you just did and you didn't try to get out of it or, you know, it's just to serve your country. And whereas here, you're right, it is. It's voluntary. There's this kind of, you know, rah-rah aspect to joining the military. And, you know, I sort of wanted to play up those differences, but also the similarities in that, you know, soldiers of all different countries are serving their country and they have to, you know, listen to and obey orders, right? They're not to blame for what their government is making them do.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And it's a concept that is, you know, not really taught to younger readers, which I really appreciated. Like the wonderful thing about middle grade books is that even as an adult, you could really appreciate the depth and the meaning and the themes. And it just makes me so happy that kids, you know, are learning all of these important lessons, but it's not in like a, I don't know, it's not like beating them over with like a hammer. Like it's a very like covert way for them to learn empathy. And one of my favorite scenes in the book is when Mei-Lan is teaching Logan why exotic is not a good term to describe her. And, you know, like, as an adult, like, I don't have patience for that. There's, like, no way. If someone called me exotic, I would probably say, don't talk to me anymore and just kind of kind of leave them behind. And I think as a kid too, I am a very no nonsense person. I've always been that kind of kid. So the fact that like Mei-Lan has so much patience and is like, okay, well, when we're going to play a game. Okay. When I say exotic, what exotic food, what do you think? And he's like sushi. And it's like, okay, well, that's not really exotic, but let's move on. Exotic animal. And, you know, she teaches him in a very relatable and non-berating way on why this is a microaggression. And I thought it was so impressive and mature for a kid to like it's something that I could learn as an adult. And I just want to ask, like, how did you come up with that scene? Like, was it difficult to like figure out like an easy, not easy, but like a very accessible way for young readers to understand that racial microaggressive term?
Yeah, it was hard. I always had the initial her shoving him off the log after he calls her that, because it's sort of a gut reaction in there. But then to explain, you know, sort of the why she reacted in such a fashion was difficult. I think it was, it took me several revisions to come up with the game idea. And I was trying to just channel, you know, what it's like to talk to children and to try explain things on, you know, a level that they can relate to. And even just for myself, I didn't have that language when I was young. And I'm trying to think about how now I would approach, you know, adults who might say that I'm exotic. I might be tempted just to walk away as well, like you would. But yeah, just like we think of so many things as exotic and, you know, people think, oh, well, exotic pets are great, you know, and, you know, what's wrong with this word? So I was trying to give the reader the language to say, you know, how othering it felt to be called
that. I really appreciated the fact that Logan, like, it's very easy to write a character who is being corrected and have them be angry and lash out. But he actually was like, you know, it's frustrating because he doesn't understand it like from the get-go, but he actually does try and he does apologize saying, hey, I'm going to say a lot of stupid things, but just like be patient with me and, you know, like correct me when I'm over, when I'm crossing the line and I'll learn. I've never been outside of Ohio. So this is, you know, this is just like my perspective. And I just thought that that was like a nice way to not shame people who don't know, quote unquote, better, because you can't blame them for their upbringing. You can't blame them for living in a town where it's not, you know, where it's like 90% white. Like no one asked for that. It just happens. And like I really appreciated that because it's not really a perspective that we see. It's usually a one way interaction where the Asian kid is like super pissed and they're like, no, super pissed or super sad. or like the white kid is just like, why are you being so upset? It's not a big deal. So it was nice that there was like this like bridge of understanding that they could reach.
I'm so glad to hear you say that. My editor and I tried really hard to have this positive interaction because Meilan and Logan are so invested in continuing their friendship, right? He's really the only person that's been nice to her so far in her new town. And he's really interested in her for, you know, his own reasons. She's the new girl, et cetera. She's interesting. And he doesn't want to get that wrong. And so I think they're sort of both more open to accepting the other person's point of view. And I wanted to show that communication is so important, you know, like to talk about these things. And instead of walking away or instead of just getting angry, to really to be an ally or to, you know, to really try and help someone else understand is important to foster empathy and, you know, open communication. And I think that so much of what's going on right now in the world is because we don't understand each other and we're not talking to each other or listening. So I really hope that starting with younger readers, they can see that, oh, okay, if I really just sort of say what I mean, hopefully they'll get it, you know.
I have to say, this is like totally random, but I laughed so hard when one of the kids in the class was like, our president said that China is the enemy. Like, aren't we in war with China? And the teacher's like, I cannot believe your dad is teaching you about, is talking about the trade war with China with you. And it just like, it just like made me laugh so hard because kids really do pick up on everything that is happening around them. And it's like, you have to be careful on what you say because they don't know any better. They'll just repeat whatever like their parents are saying. And that's really important.
And they're not getting the whole story.
Yeah, exactly.
They're not, you know, reading the news and they don't understand that the tariffs are not a person.
That was really funny, too. You know, it's like, it's we're in war with someone called the tariffs. And it's like, kid, no.
Yeah. And at the same time, I wanted to recognize that, you know, there are impacts to the Midwest of the things that the government and the previous administration were doing. And, you know, that those are a reality for a lot of white kids, right? Their parents have lost jobs or, you know, have had a difficult time as well. So I sort of wanted to recognize that, but at the same time, sort of gently correct that thinking.
Yeah. So the book is out on August 17th. So you're in the midst of your, I guess, promotional tour right now. How's that going for you so far? Not with like, you know, it looks like things are closing down again.
Oh, yeah. It's going well. I think we've all had to learn to pivot, right? Mm. During the past 18 months. I did have a book release in March and you know, everything was on, you know, streaming, Zoom or Crowdcast or whatever. So we've all sort of had to learn all these different platforms and adjust, which is why I have multiple microphones for different situations. It's been good in a way because I don't have to travel across the country and I can just sort of, you know, log in from anywhere, which has been nice. But I do miss the energy of seeing people in person and that sort of celebratory air when, you know, people are right there asking for your book to be signed. It's really, it's fun. I miss that. But I'm hoping that I can have at least one in-person event before, if things shut down before that happens. I'm really hoping we can turn it around before that happens.
Yeah, hopefully a school visit somehow. Like, I think with children's book authors, it's always the best to have kids ask questions. And it's just like, you see the light just in their eyes when they meet like the person who wrote the book that they read over and over again. So I really hope you do get to experience that with this book. So we're winding down to the end of our time. And I have to ask this, what is your favorite pie? Because you wrote a lot of scenes with desserts and with Malon's dad making pie. And as a pie enthusiast, I just have to know, what is your favorite pie?
I would have said apple, I think. But then a few years ago, I had a chocolate silk pie. And I think that has to be my favorite now. It's very light and airy, but very chocolatey and creamy at the same time. So yeah, I really love to bake. And so that probably comes across in the book. And I like to eat dessert.
I'm definitely going to get pie after this recording ends. There's a pie hole near in my town. So I'm definitely just after this, I'm going to go get boba. I'm going to get pie and enjoy.
What kind of pie,
oh,
Mira?
Man. They have so many different kinds because they have like savory pies. They have like a Thanksgiving pie with turkey and cranberries inside. But then like for sweet pie, I know they had like a rose lavender pie. And I'm like, that sounds really good right now. I love any kind of fruit pie. My very specific favorite type of pie is cherry pie from the Twin Peaks Cafe up in Seattle. That diner / cafe exists. It's real. Their cherry pie is really, really good, which is why they advertise it a lot in that show. So, yeah. If you're ever in Seattle, go to the Twin Peaks Diner. They have great cherry pie. All right. Well, I think... that about does it, Marvin, right?
Yeah. Thank you so much, Andrea, for joining us on Books and Boba. Such an honor. And also, you know, you told us before we started that you are a big fan of the show, and that makes us very
self-conscious.
But thank you
so
much.
I didn't mean to make you uncomfortable.
No, like, we're happy. It's just like, people, when we're alone in our rooms in front of a microphone, like, we forget that there are people actually listening to us. So.
We forget there are people listening to us that we actually talk about
that's
on the
true,
show.
That's so true. That's true. It's like, I'm sorry. Like, I criticize your book, but it's all in, like, good faith.
You have to have a thick skin to endure in this business. So it's okay.
Yeah, but thank you so much for writing this amazing book. I'm probably just going to give this copy to one of my nieces.
I was about to say, you should give it
to your
niece.
I have a niece that really loves to read.
All right. Well, I was going to offer you a signed book plate.
Oh.
Offer still stands. Thank you so much for having me on the show. I've really enjoyed it.
Awesome. And good luck on the rest of your book tour. And hopefully you get that physical book release that you're dreaming of. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that was our interview with Andrea Wang, the author of The Many Meanings of Mei Lan, available today, August 17th, at booksellers everywhere. Rira, that was a really great conversation.
Yeah, had a lot of fun. Lots of laughs, lots of tea spilling here and there.
It's so amazing to talk about Asian names with someone and to have them completely understand, right? I mean, that's the bond you and I share for having like kind of weird names even within our own cultures.
Yep, definitely. I've only met one other person with the same name as me, and we were both very shocked. We're like, another one of us exists. That means we have to kill the other. There can only be one.
I don't think that's how names work.
No.
So yeah, thank you to Andrea for speaking with us. Rira, please remind our listeners what our book club pick for August 2021 is.
Our book for August 2021 is Patron Saints of Nothing by Randy Rebay. It's a YA contemporary novel. It's a little bit dark, so go in with a little bit of caution. It is about a Filipino-American teen who flies to the Philippines to learn the behind the scenes about his cousin's murder, which happened during President Duterte's war on drugs.
We'll be discussing this book at the end of the month. So if you've already finished it, please let us know your thoughts on our Goodreads forums. But yeah, looking forward to discussing that book with you, Rira.
Yeah.
And on that note, that'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you all next time. Bye, everyone. Right.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu, and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @BooksandBoba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey Brian, did you go to Saturday school as a kid?
I sure did. Did you?
Totally.
Well, at our podcast, Saturday School, we don't teach a language, but we pass along the culture that we do know.
And that's Asian American pop culture.
Ada is a journalist, and I'm a professor and film festival programmer.
We've watched a lot of great Asian American movies, and we want you to watch them too. Come listen to us as we look back at the pioneering films that have led us to today.